On this episode of Baseball Barbecast, we welcome special guest Pedro Martinez. Pretty good pitcher, pretty good podcast guest. You'll hear his thoughts on some of the best pitchers in the game today. Take a trip down memory lane of his career and talk about the Dominican Winter League, which means so much to us. We also talk about Kyle Schwarber hitting 50 home runs, not all in one day, but he did reach 50 this week. Jake was there in Philly to tell us all about it. Roki Sasaki is throwing hard again, and we go around the league for a few other bits of news and notes in Major League Baseball. All that and more on this episode of Baseball Barbecast.
Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbecast, the only baseball podcast in the world who thinks that Pedro Martinez fella might turn into a good pitcher one day. I'm Jake Mintz. That's Jordan Schusterman, and if he keeps working hard and believing in himself, I mean, the sky's the limit.
And if you don't believe us, you can hear it from the man himself as Pedro Martinez joins Baseball Barbecast. Later on in this episode, we had a wonderful chat with the Hall of Famer yesterday, which you're going to hear as the bulk of this Wednesday edition of Baseball Barbecast. We have a few topics before, a few topics after, but let's be real. You saw Pedro Martinez in the pod title. You clicked on it, and I promise you, I think this you're going to enjoy this conversation. We certainly did, and this was a cool opportunity. As I joked on Twitter, I can't say promise that Hall of Famers every few weeks is going to be the standard here at Baseball Barbecast. If we can somehow get to that point, that would be awesome, but yeah. Coming off Cal Ripken going to Pedro Martinez, pretty cool.
You almost said Cal Raleigh, which is awesome, instead of Cal Ripken. Totally understandable.
Hall of Famer someday.
If you would like to come on the podcast, let us know if you're in the Hall of Fame. We'd love to have you. If you're not in the Hall of Fame, there are tons of other podcasts out there that I'm sure would be happy to have you. That's the standard that we set here at Baseball Barbecast. And speaking of high standards, let's hop into our opener. What is a big number, really? One is a big number if you're talking about times you summited Everest. I would say five is a big number if you're talking about how many times you got married. And I would say 50 is a big number if we're talking home runs. And that is what Kyle Schwarber achieved last night here in Philadelphia, where I am at the moment. Clobbering his 50th long ball of the year, a laser beam shot to center field against Justin Hagenman of the New York Mets, Schwarber becoming only the second player in the history of the Philadelphia Phillies franchise to reach the 50 home run mark. He is the second player this season after Cal Raleigh to reach that mark. And we will probably end up with three players hitting 50 once Aaron Judge gets his crap together. But this was a moment. This was a beautiful night for Kyle Schwarber, who is having just a sensational season for the Phillies.
Four, right? Otani's closer than Judge is, and Suarez only needs five more. So, I mean, this has been one hell of a slugging season. But let's keep the focus on Schwarber here. We've had some big picture conversations about him recently, of course, with his four-homer game. That certainly grabbed our attention. But I am glad you are leaning into the 50 and what that number means in a historical context and just in the like very aesthetic, you know, just the visceral moment of like 50 home runs, right? And, 50. You know, I don't think you get the big 30 graphic when a guy gets to 30 homers, right? I don't think you kind of pause. 30 isn't getting the curtain call. 40. Sometimes, maybe if it's the first time a guy gets there, you'll see it. But 50 requires a pause and an acknowledgement. And it does seem like Schwarber got that moment last night during the game from the fans and post-game as well. And as we've kind of talked about with him, again, it's not like this dude just figured out how to hit home runs. He's been hitting home runs for the last decade. And in some ways, that's what makes this season so special, is that he has already been a prolific power hitter for the entirety of his career. And at no point before this year did he even get to 48, right? So 46 in his first year with the Phillies, 47 in his second year, only 38 last year. Just a real disappointing showing. and then 50 this year and counting. I think what's most incredible is you go back and look at his Cubs career when he is starting to really peak. Of course, he has this legendary, iconic showing early in, you know, in 2016 coming back from the injury. But as far as the totality of a season, the fact that he only hit 38 in 2019 with the most juiced ball in league history is kind of amazing and helps me appreciate that he did 50 this year even more. So it is an amazing accomplishment, and I agree. 50 does kind of take your breath away a little bit more.
It was great last night during the post game. Rob Thompson's like, really great night. Ranger Suarez was awesome. You know, Kyle going for his 50th and Bryson Stott, 500th career hit. And after the game, I went up to Bryson Stott. I was like, what a selfish move by Kyle to hit his 50th on the night that you reach 500. And Bryson's like, dude, I didn't know I got 500 hits tonight. Like, I had no idea.
That was interesting. I saw that because I know Thompson also acknowledged it in the Phillies posted the little toast they did post game. And
got to post a toast.
I was like, oh, hashtag, wow. Like, hey, that is, yeah.
All teams, hashtag post the toast. Okay.
Hashtag post the toast. Listen,
we want to see the toast.
Bleep out the F bombs. You can bleep out, you can, you know, that's fine. But give us the moment where everyone's raising a glass. And I loved it in that one because he did the Stott one was the appetizer. And I will say, I was like, oh, wow, that is a lot of hits for Bryson Stott, who I feel like just got here. So good for him. I don't know if he's getting to 3,000, but, you know, 500 hits, that's a cool amount. But it is not as cool as 50 home runs. And we'll open this up and do some bigger Phillies Mets stuff here in a second. But yeah, man, I mean, this Schwarber thing, the fact that we are heading towards a very interesting free agency, the fact that he has had these four straight incredible seasons, one of the more productive free agent contracts we've ever seen, and what he has become in this city this quickly is pretty special. So, yep, special player, special person, and I'm excited to see how many more home runs he can hit, because listen, we know they'll come in bunches. He's still got, what, 16, 17 games left? Like, I don't know if he's catching Ryan Howard, but I think he's going to hit a few more homers.
Schwarber at home is a very special watch for a couple of reasons. So, like, I was talking, I think it was MLB.com beat writer Todd Zalecki, who covers the Phillies. I was talking to him about this last year. I was like, hey, you got kids, like, your kids like watching ball. And he's like, my kids love? My kids love Schwarbombs. My kids, they want to come to the yard and they want to see some freaking Schwarbombs. They want to see the big guy with the big beard hit the ball super far. And when you watch Schwarber at home, every time he swings, the place gets quiet like a golf drive on the 18th at the Masters, right? Because everyone is there. I mean, they're there for the atmosphere. They're there to see a good team, Bryce Harper, all that. But at this point right now, like, the whole franchise is like exists as a platform for Kyle Schwarber to hit the ball really far. And I love that. It's just such a simple, beautiful thing. Big man, strong man, hit ball hard and far. And it boils the sport down to like its simplest form in a way that is very digestible and enjoyable for a lot of people. And to the point that when he hit the 50th, it said 50 Schwarbombs. Like, it literally said Schwarbombs on the scoreboard.
That's good. Hey, that's great branding. That's just good in-game entertainment. We love that. No, it's true. And listen, the guy that he is going up there trying to hit the ball over the fence. There's not really a secret it's about great. That. It is more advanced, like, in that, in the way he's going about it. But that is pretty much the bit.
People are always like, oh, I love that guy. He's not trying to do too much up there. Schwarber is trying to do all of it, right? Like, he's trying to do too much in a good way.
Yeah.
But it was really cool to be there for that. This is my first time in Philadelphia since April, late April, early May, which for someone who lived in New York and is now in DC, I spent a lot of time here over the years being around that team. And it, for whatever reason, I just hadn't really been here at all. And so it was kind of nice to be here and watch what is a very entertaining ball club and one of the best atmospheres in the game. And they're in a really interesting spot now. That win last night against the Mets pushed their lead in the NL East to, I believe, 9 games. There are 2 more Phillies-Mets games here at the bank. If the Mets take them both and they push that back down to 7, I mean, sure, we could pretend there's a race. The last 2 wins kind of feels like the division is done and dusted at this point.
That said, while the division race is likely over because you are there in Philly, let's get to your field report. Jake, you have more to tell us.
Some interesting things swirling around here in Philadelphia. Trey Turner and Alec Bohm, the entire left side of the infield, going on the IL. Turner, that one is more concerning, respectfully, to Alec Bohm, because Turner leads all National League players in wins above replacement. He has gone from a middling defensive shortstop to one of the best glovesmiths over there in all of baseball this season. He's having one of his best offensive all-around seasons in a long time, leading off for the Phillies, giving that offense a different dynamic. And we talked about this on the show the other day when we heard the news. It does seem like it's on the milder end. He is going to likely be ready to go by the playoffs, but there are 2 things that are important about that timeline with him. One, just because he's able to play does not necessarily mean that he is full go Trey Turner. And I think this is something to understand about players and injuries in general, right? Just because they are playing does not mean they are their best version of themselves. And for a player like Turner, whose value is very dependent on speed, mobility, and agility, I have some concerns about that hamstring. There is him being on the field and him being full go. That means that the Phillies getting the bye in the first round to buy themselves another 5 days of Trey Turner nap time is very valuable and is now the next priority for this team with the division in the rear view.
Which is, you know, Dodgers are playing better, but they do have, I think, still a 4-game lead over them. So they're in position to do that. And if they can really, you know, clinch that in the next week and a half, they might be able to give Turner some off days even in the regular season, right? And as you mentioned, with a hamstring like that, and for a guy who is going to be dependent on his speed on both sides of the ball, that is definitely a big deal. That said, while the short term is still like, okay, what's the top of this lineup going to look like? Because of how well Harrison Bader has been playing as they plop him into the leadoff spot. I know Bryce Harper had a day at leadoff. We call up Otto Kemp, who is a very easy fan favorite and definitely one of my favorite stories on this Phillies team that doesn't have, again, we've talked so much about the Phillies. They don't really have rookies, right? This has not really been part of their bit over the last few years. So to have a player like Otto Kemp, who I think is the only rookie eligible player on the team right now. I mean, I believe they were the last team this season to even have a major league debut. And I think it was Otto Kemp. So with that in mind, I mean, even anything that he can contribute, whether it's off the bench or, you know, filling in for Turner in some form or another, I'm certainly enjoying it. And especially in contrast to Castellanos, who is about as, I know he's started to be a little bit more productive the last few days, but still, it's nice to see a fresh face for this Phillies team that we've grown so used to seeing. Not that these aren't players we enjoy watching already, but Otto Kemp, I've enjoyed him.
Also, the Ottoman Kempire, a nickname that has gone big on Phillies Twitter. A couple fans showed up to his game in Lehigh Valley with a Ottoman Kempire flag, which is like, great job. This is bringing memery.
It's so
to
big.
The ball yard. It's such a big flag. It says, "I will die for my country, Philadelphia." It displays him with some Turkish symbolism. This is great. He signed it, explaining the bit to Otto Kemp. Great example. Like, there are some bits where when you explain them to players, they're like, "Oh yeah, I get that." Otto Kemp was probably like, "Sure, yeah, I'll sign this Turkish flag with my face on it. Like, whatever, man." I also enjoy that as the team's only rookie, he is 26, a very advanced age for a rookie, and perfectly in line with the Phillies' veteran squad. We mentioned that the NL East here is a bit of a rapsky. A lot of that has to do with the deadline. You know, deadline hindsight usually gets done during the winter, or once all the dust and the confetti has settled. But we're at a point now where, like, the Phillies deadline acquisitions versus the Mets deadline acquisitions is not on a war basis the difference in the division. But dude, comparing Harrison Bader, Johan Duran, and, you know, David Robertson as a sign versus Ryan Helsley and Cedric Mullins, I mean, night and day.
Yeah, and honestly, I think it's also funny for the Phillies in particular. I mean, you could apply this to the Mets to some degree. But, you know, from an off-season standpoint, before the season, with, like, vibes were not awesome, right? With Romano, yeah. With, you know, with Kepler, true. Who's, you know, had a few moments, but not really anything awesome. You know, it's been a lot where it's like, really, like, this is what we did going into this season. And instead, now, you know, Dombrowski does his work at the deadline. No surprise. Of course, you've heard me shower as much praise as possible about the being aggressive and getting Duran done. But Robertson has obviously helped, and Bader has certainly helped. And it's a nice little group. Whereas, yeah, the Mets, Mullins especially has been a pretty tough watch.
Yeah. Jose Siri back, so maybe he'll figure into the center field mix a little bit more. The last thing I mentioned about the Phillies before we move forward is the fart. You want to talk about the fart?
Yes. Fart with a PH. Please tell me more.
Did you come up with that? Fart.
Capital P. I mean, I'm assuming that it was out there. There's been so much discourse about this toot lately that, I mean,
forget
I can
Bland.
Tell you. Yeah.
For those of you who don't know, Aaron Nola was sensational in game one of the series against the Mets. During his post-game interview, a loud bout of flatulence could be heard very clearly during the post-game interview. Nola, I would say, held firm and did not break character pretty impressively.
Here's what chuckle.
Together. If you don't chuckle, you're a total psycho. You know what I mean? Like, if you're full stoic in the face of a fart. So, you know, this was the topic of discussion yesterday in the room. And Nola told myself and the Athletic's Matt Gelb that members of his family believed that Nola himself was the toot perpetrator. Which is hilarious because I'm not breaking news here. He was not. I mean, you can tell from the video he was not. But that both his mom and wife texted him to say, why did you fart? So Nola, innocent. I will say this. It has to be someone with service time. Okay? It has to be someone with service
ruled
time.
Out.
Ruled out. Just because... You know, if you're a rookie, you have to be like Drew Gilbert maybe could fart. We'll talk about him on Friday. Right. But you got to have some veteran time to rip out a toot. And I think that I cannot confirm exactly who it was. I have some suspicions. I think it was a more experienced member of the Phillies clubhouse.
Which unfortunately does not narrow it down very much, but that's fine. I think that this will remain a recurring storyline. I wouldn't even rule out that we're getting another one at some point. If there was ever a clubhouse that was going to run a bit back, it would absolutely be this. And we will see whether it's the same person or not. Who's to say? Maybe we find out, maybe we don't. But I don't think this story is over. I think, and I kind of hope that it's only during Aaron Nola press conferences.
Oh, like, good call.
Like, I hope that it just becomes a burden for Nola to deal with. Assuming, you know, it's also probably, like, if he goes out and gives up 4 home runs, I don't think anyone's going to go
good
fart.
Good Nola starts. Wins. You can only fart after wins.
But good Nola starts. I think we might have this, something here.
This reminds me of, like, when I was in college and we'd, like, lose a game. And like people are talking on the bus on the way back. It's like, no talking on the bus. No, like talk after wins. No farting on the bus.
Yeah.
No, like fart after
no
wins.
Fart. Over, no farting under, after losses. Yeah.
Over under farts during Aaron Nola press conferences the rest of the year, playoffs included, 1.5.
1.5. I can't go over 1.5, but I feel like
I will.
Like the chances of, okay, so we're getting multiple. This is going to be, we're really going to push this into October. Okay, all right, we'll see. I hope you're right.
Great.
Again, I said, I would love some consistency. You know, we don't need to do this for Ranger Suarez. I think Nola is a perfect one, especially now knowing that his family thought it was him, which is really surprising. I don't know, but maybe we learned something from that. Maybe that tells me that Nola is doing a lot of farting behind the scenes, like with his family. And he thinks that's something that in private he thinks is funny. We think, oh, Aaron Nola would never do that. Anyway, all right, enough fart chat.
Now we're going to transition from that to Pedro Martinez.
Yes, okay. So thank you for the field report, Jake. I appreciate that. Speaking of the Mets and Phillies, Pedro Martinez, who
speaking of
pitch
blowing it
for the
past people.
Yeah. Yeah.
Speaking
right.
of letting it rip.
Pedro on the 09 Phillies. Guess what? I'll be honest, folks, we're not going to talk to Pedro about the Phillies in this. No. Actually, a little bit, a tiny bit. We got a little bit of Christopher Sanchez chat. We'll shut up and let you hear our conversation with Pedro Martinez. This was fantastic. This was very enjoyable. This was a great conversation. At the very end, you're going to hear us talk about the Dominican Winter League with an awesome story. Of course, if you listen to this show, you know it is a league we care very much about. It is something that has come to define our offseason experience. It is why I am wearing my Escogido hat today. It is also timely because the Dominican Winter League rookie draft is happening tonight, which you can watch on YouTube. And this is a draft where these teams get to pick players who are going to be part of their teams. Now, these are players that are unlikely to be playing this season, although it is possible. You will become eligible for the Dominican Winter League rookie draft when you reach A ball in the minor leagues. And so that year, this means top prospects such as Jesus Mate with the Milwaukee Brewers, Luis Pena with the Milwaukee Brewers, Carlos LaGrange, hard-throwing righty for the New York Yankees, Felnin Celestine with the Seattle Mariners, and you know the like. Some of these guys will never play in this league because they're going to get too good. And their major league teams are going to say, sorry, dude, you can't go to the minors or you can't go
Juan
to
Soto.
Some of them
never played winter.
Some of them. Yeah. So, yeah, right. Some of them might have a Junior Caminero moment. Now, Junior Caminero has set this bar extremely high for what he did over the last couple winters. That said, these are players that we care very much about. And as you will hear from Pedro, this is a league that does matter for players' development and can make a real impact. And so we just wanted to set that up as a nice timely tie-in. But guess what? There is no bad time to talk to Pedro Martinez. And that is why I'm going to shut up, send us to break. And when we return, we hope you enjoy our conversation with the Hall of Famer. We'll be right back.
And welcome back to Baseball Barbecast. We are honored to be joined by a guest with 3,154 more strikeouts than the two of us combined. Pedro Martinez, Hall of Famer. How you doing, my friend?
I'm doing great. Thank you for having me, guys. It's an honor.
Of course. It's an honor to have you. I'm sure people throw stats out for you all the time. Do you ever go back and look at your own stats?
You know what? I don't really look at my stats, but it shocks me to see how much stuff is brought up, especially nowadays with social media. Every once in a while, you know, I'm just checking my phone or whatever, going through Facebook and Instagram, and there's stuff. Someone has numbers and comparisons to other seasons and stuff like that, and it really shocks me to know that I did all that, because I never really stopped to look at how my career was going or what I was about to do. I was just about doing it right. But I wasn't really aware how time would later tell me about the things that I did.
Because when you're in it, you're just trying to win baseball games and get hitters out. And then you wake up 18 years later and you have a 2.93. In 2,800 innings. Pretty impressive.
Well, I'm watching now up close some of the guys that are doing stuff, incredible stuff, like Tarik Skubal. I've seen Verlander, Scherzer do things, Kershaw, more, you know, most recently. And I get really glued into the TV and the numbers and stuff like that. But then, little you know, I'm in one of those boxes with every one of them that have done something really special. Yeah. And I just went, you know, all out when I wanted to do what I needed to do. But I never stopped to think that I would be in some of those boxes. And surprising to me, I get to see it now that I have enough time to kind of go through it.
Well, and it's really cool that you're really getting at something that we wanted to talk about with you, which is the current game, which of course you know been working with TBS, you know, doing the pre and post game and talking about the best pitchers of today. And you kind of mentioned that experience of seeing what a Skubal or a Skeens or a Crochet is doing. And they might throw up and be like, first since Pedro Martinez. And you might have those moments like, wow, I must have been pretty good if this guy's throwing pretty well. So I must have been throwing pretty well. Have you had any? I guess you mentioned it seems like you have had some moments like that.
Yeah, I watch those guys and I don't get enough of them, especially, you know, their presence on the mound. When I see Tarik Skubal, when I see Paul Skeens, when I see Crochet, Jacob DeGrom, like I love Jacob DeGrom, his presence, his calm on the mound. Some guys just have that elite presence when they step on top of the mound. And I love to see that from the player, that sense of security.
Yeah. Can you learn that over time? Mm. Or is that just something guys have? You know, I think about Christopher Sanchez as an example, right? Where it was a very slow climb for him, where he didn't show up in the big leagues and was an ace. But now you watch him and he's in command. He's in control. He's confident. He's one of the best pitchers in the world. Is that something that you have, that dominant presence, that aggressiveness, or is that something that a player can learn over time?
I think you're born with the desire to be that guy, but you have to put a lot of time into it. And another guy that I'm going to give you that went from up on top, probably the best presence on the mound, to a guy that was shaky this year. And you guys are going to be shocked how much attention I paid to little things. Sandy Alcantara was reluctant to give the ball away, was probably the best pitcher for about 3 years where he would complete games. He was like out of place. The way the game is changing, Sandy Alcantara was out of place for a guy that was young but had that mindset to go and finish what he started, which is something you weren't supposed to see at the time the game was changing towards probably what it is now. A lot of relievers, 5 or 6 innings, 0 complete games and stuff like that. But you learn to actually get comfortable on top of the mound. You learn how to become dominant on the mound. And it gives you the confidence to say, I am this guy on top of the mound. I'm this bully on top of the mound. And Paul Skeens is a rare breed of, you know, men's and inside of, you know, of a uniform. And so is Tarik Skubal, Crochet. Those guys seem to have it from the first moment they stepped on the mound to this point of their career where they are possible Cy Youngs, Rookie of the Year, a lot of success. Now, I hope I don't see it soon, but when they fail, I want to see when things don't go right, when things ache in your body and you have to kind of get down and come back up. I would love to see how they respond to that, but not now, not anytime soon. I would love to see them cracking up some records that I have and everyone that have passed through the game.
But and we kind of saw that from Crochet the last 2 weeks where he was great last night for his 7 scoreless, but the start before that, he got crushed at home against Cleveland, let up 4 home runs, 7 earned. And I remember like watching his face after letting up the 4th home run. And he couldn't believe it. Like it didn't compute in his mind. He was like, I gave up 4 home runs. And then to see him go out there last night and throw, you know, 7 scoreless and strike out all those hitters, that's kind of what you're talking about, that, right? That bouncing back from failure.
Exactly. And if you don't have that in you, if you don't have the, you know, the ability to be a short-minded kind of person and put that stuff behind, you're going to struggle for a longer time. For special guys like those that we just mentioned, I think they have the ability to put it behind. And it's not how many times you fall. It's how many times you stand up after failure. It was the same way for me. I had a short memory for that. It was like, okay, you got me today. I wish I could be pitching against you 5 days later so I could go and get my revenge against you. That's competitiveness. And I think those guys all have it. And I would love to see them healthy and continue to do that. And I wish I could see more pitchers with the same attitude and the same confidence that they display on top of the mound. I love watching those guys. And actually, it's really interesting for me to be watching the race for the Cy Young. Watching Scooble go at it, he seems to have, like, you know, the far front lead on the other guys. But Crochet, especially after seeing what I saw last night, and don't put away Chapman. What Chapman is doing deserves a lot of looks from all of us, people in baseball, people that have interest in baseball, and the fans. I think what Chapman is doing is unbelievable. And in any other season where you had mediocre starting pitcher, Chapman would have been considered for the Cy Young. And that a lot of that probably has to see with the team. If the team was to put him in a place where he had a lot more saves and a lot more opportunities to save games, Chapman would have been in the Cy Young contention. Remember Clase? Clase was right there, down the wire with the Scooble. And I think Chapman probably had the same opportunity if the team was doing better or put him in place to save games.
So I'm glad you mentioned Chapman, and we just talked about Crochet a little bit. We did want to talk to you about this Red Sox season. Obviously, as part of your job, clearly you are watching the whole league. It is not like you are just tuned into the Red Sox. That said, we know, you know, you have the Red Sox, of course, a special place in your career, and as you still continue to have that relationship with the franchise. This has been quite the season for them. They are in playoff position, but it has been rather dramatic. There have been a lot of moves. There have been a lot of great performances, disappointing performances. We've been joking all season, man, we should have had the Netflix documentary this year, because, oh my goodness, has there been a lot happening compared to last season. But what is your take on this Red Sox season? What again, they're in a good place. I think when you see them at their best, they look like a really good team. But there's a lot going on there. And with the Devers trade and everything, what has been your general big picture takeaway from this Red Sox season so far, and where they could go from here?
The big picture, everything looks great. Devers seemed to be settled in San Francisco. The young kids that we brought up from the organization have done their job. They're making adjustment. I'm really quick to watch how they respond to adversity. Campbell is one example. How they deal with adversity. And for Cora and the rest of the guys, was a learning lesson this year. How to handle baseball stuff within baseball, within the clubhouse. For the entire organization, was a learning lesson. For Breslow, is a learning lesson. For me, is a learning lesson. For all of us that have never seen something like that, it's a learning lesson. It also gives you, the refreshing news to know that the talent is really all together, that all you need is kind of get comfortable, build that confidence while playing the game, and believe that you are that guy. Like we were talking about the pitchers.
Yeah.
But those young players that the Red Sox have right now in the big leagues are showing that they are improving every single game that they play. They are gaining the confidence that we talk about. They are starting to feel that they belong where they are. It took Duran a little while to kind of feel confident enough to say, I am a superstar. I am a star of the game. I can go out there and play the way I know, and I'm going to be successful. So for the rest of the young players that are coming up and watching guys like Bregman, you know, go out there and do what they do and how they go about their business, I think it's really important. Also, their catching. I think those two guys, Wong and Narvaez, have done an outstanding job at handling everything and adjusting. That a lot has to see with Jason being linked to those guys. I know Jason loves those guys. He doesn't stop working. The Red Sox were a learning lesson this year, but a positive one. I would say that.
And you bring up Narvaez. I think he's such an interesting character for this Red Sox team. To trust a rookie to run the show back there. And, you know, nowadays, catchers are doing more than ever before, right? They have to handle so many more responsibilities. And to trust a rookie, who they got from the Yankees, by the way, to let that guy go, I think has just been so impressive. I wanted to ask you actually about Alex Bregman. So from the outside, we're not in clubhouses, right? Like, we're not on the team. And so when we see someone who's like, this is a really good clubhouse guy, it's hard for us on the outside to know what that means and how that works. Alex Bregman this year seems to have has risen his game as a clubhouse person, right? Where he is one of the more important people in the game to make others around him better. I'm curious, is that something that you've seen, and how important is that type of player in a room?
That is the best part of Bregman's game, is his ability to mingle with everybody, get along with everybody, and display his experience.
Yeah.
Bregman is an outstanding person, first of all. I guarantee you that the stuff in Houston is one of the things that led to Bregman wanting to have a change of scenery. Because I've seen the human, and a lot of you don't stop to see the human inside a uniform, but I do. And I was one of those guys. He doesn't like distractions. He likes to play. This is a guy that will leave the skin in the field. But at the same time, it's like he's so approachable. He's so easy to deal with that you can actually treat him like he's just one more rookie in the pile. You can approach him that way, get close to him. He's serious enough for everybody to understand that if you're not playing the same way I'm playing, well, you're not going to get my best face, and you'll probably see me snap. And it's not by saying words, but he's going to be angry at you not giving 100%. So everybody rubs off Bregman when they play the game. And you can see it in the rookies. It's 100% concentration. Bad stuff are going to happen. Mistakes are going to happen. But you have to be mentally in the game. And that's what Bregman brings to the field. Bregman brings a guy that's really approachable. He's a superstar. He's a champion. And I guarantee you, he did not want any distractions, and he learned to love Boston just like Boston is loving Bregman. And that's the one thing I always say. Why I love homegrown players, because they learn to identify themselves with the city of Boston. Boston is the most knowledgeable city in all of baseball, I would say. WEI, 24/7, talking sports. I mean, it's about the Red Sox, the Celtics, and the Patriots all the time. So the people are going to have to hear whether they want or not. Every time they turn WEI on, it's sports and it's about the players. So Boston is always very demanding, but very passionate about their players and very supportive. So if you don't love Boston and you don't want to hear your name 24/7, then you shouldn't be in Boston, because you're going to be mentioned in the good moments, just like in the bad moments. And that's the one tricky thing about Boston. But if you play the game right, you go all out for Boston, they will realize that you're going all out, even if the results are not there. They understand exactly how the players think. Social media doesn't make it any easier for the players, because anything you post, they're reading. They love their players. They love to read. They love to know about their players. So you have to love Boston. And Bregman is one of those guys that have expressed that he loves Boston more than he ever thought. And so do the young players coming from home. This is our team. This is what we were born to do with the team that we were born to do. So I love that. And the good thing is the young players are coming up to a guy that loves playing the game in the city he's playing. Yeah. And the city is embracing every one of them.
And I think it's really important, and you could probably talk to this too. Bregman is fluent in Spanish. And
Oh, yes, he is.
That helps, right, in being able to talk to everybody in the clubhouse.
Yeah, but everybody else is also fluent in English.
Yeah.
Like you ask Rafaela, Rafaela knows like seven languages.
Yeah. So, Bregman's got to go learn Papiamento.
Yeah, yeah, that's and you never know, because Breg is really smart, yeah. And he takes pride on talking to everybody. Narvaez, all those guys, they can communicate with each other really well. Plus, they know each other now.
Yeah.
Whether it was from the minor leagues or coming into spring training, that's the one thing Boston does well. They actually hold a program where they have some of the prospects go back to Dominican, mingle with the people, learn about the culture and all that before they actually start playing for the Red Sox.
So, Pedro, we've obviously gone over a little bit of your view of the game today and the Red Sox today. We did want to take the opportunity to look back a little bit farther at your career. There are two things we really wanted to dig into. The first thing is pretty broad, which is just like you mentioned you're maybe not going back and looking at your stats, but were there specific matchups that stood out over the course of your career? Were there hitters that gave you more fits than you expected? Were there hitters that you did struggle with? Obviously, over the course of your career, you did better than the hitters did. That's very obvious. But were there some matchups that still stick in your memory as especially memorable? And then maybe we'll give you a few little minor trivia questions related to this.
You know what? I hated seeing Jeter in a tough at bat. In the postseason. That is in the postseason. Because Jeter had the ability to just give you knuckles during the postseason. Matsui was another guy that during the postseason was just off. During the regular season, believe it or not, I did really well against the guy that I thought gave me knuckles. That will be Edgar Martinez.
Mm-hmm.
I did an outstanding job against Edgar.
Wow.
But man, it would take me... 12 pitches, 9 pitches, 11 pitches. So I hated that because if I was going to complete the game, all of a sudden I need to come out in the seventh inning because Edgar was in the middle of the 3 or 4 at-bats where I had to just battle my way around Edgar.
Yeah.
With Junior, I didn't have problems.
Yeah.
Buehner, those guys, A-Rod, I didn't feel like I had that much work to do.
So against Edgar was 3 for 25 against you. And yeah. Of those, ready for this? You had 33 plate appearances against him, 11 full counts.
That's what I'm talking about. I'm telling you. And not only that, the full counts came after 5 or 6 fouls on fastballs that I'm cranking myself up to get it 98, 97, 96 and above to get him out. And then you know what that does to you, right? You have to get off the mound and go, I need a little breath of air because you're holding everything you have to put Edgar away. Still can't. And then at the end, when he finally wear you out, you go and lay the fastball there and he might pop it up or whatever or get a hit or something like that. I hated facing Edgar during the regular season because I never had the opportunity to see him in the postseason. But the other guys I'm talking about, and there are many guys that wore me out, like, you know, will hit 300 of me, like Kenny Lofton, pesky players like that will hit well against me, Luis Gonzalez. But I didn't feel bad about facing those guys because they were going to get it done. Whether get the hits.
It was going to go fast.
Yeah, it was going to go fast. And I would have loved the clock.
Right.
When I was fishing, but
man,
yeah, that's a fact. But those guys gave me knuckles during the regular season, but it didn't matter. If you got them first, and I could get a ground ball with the next guy, okay, that's okay.
It is fun to look at, like Jeter. You look at the numbers. You got him in the regular season, But in the postseason, you're right. Like, he was just a different player, man.
He was a different player because Jeter had the ability to just keep his composure, whether it was postseason or regular season. You didn't know when Jeter was going bad, just like you didn't know when Jeter was going, you know, 5 for 5. And that's the kind of player that you hate to see in a tough situation because you want them to get excited. I wanted you getting mad at me. I wanted you to go after me.
Play
I
want
you
game.
To give me that dirty look, like I want to kill you, like Sheffield would do if you did something against them. Those guys that brought aggression towards you, I wanted you to be aggressive so that I could put my stuff in display and frustrate you.
Which is
and just like they wanted to do to me, too.
So the guy who was probably the worst against you with over 20 at-bats is exactly that type of hitter, Pat Burrell, who was very aggressive, swung a lot, went 1 for 26 with 11 strikeouts against you. And I imagine, like you said, it's because he was probably more willing to play into the game that you wanted to play.
Oh, yeah. I would love those guys that would come after me.
Yeah.
The little pesky ones that you know, had little swings and wanted to put the ball and play the other way. Those were the ones that I hate. Like the Kenny Loftons of the world, Jerry Hairston Jr., Luis Gonzalez, that you break their bats and there's the blooper. Miguel Cairo. Guys like that. I didn't like to face those. And I went after them because I wanted to get it done quickly. But they would take advantage of that first base strike or first 1-2 fastballs to go at you, and they'll get some hits off of it.
So the one last one I wanted to ask you about is Barry Bonds, because you allowed one home run to Barry Bonds. That was the day I was born.
yeah, I'm old.
The day I was born, September 5th, 1995.
So that means you could have been my son.
I could have been your son.
Yeah,
yes, sir.
Good looking. You're very good looking. So
thank you. I appreciate it.
I would have been
it.
A blessed father with such a good looking kid.
Thank you, brother. Brother from looking. Another mother.
Yeah.
You know, like, so one home run, right? You faced him 33 times. He's got more homers than everyone else. I've always wanted to ask you about that home run, if there's anything that you remember from facing Barry.
I do remember clear. Like, I was flying under the radar, and I had this hitter. You know, he saw me as a reliever, but he never seen me like a starter. And I think I had a couple of outings where I was just sneaking by without giving up anything to Barry. And the pitching coach in Montreal, Joe Kerrigan, was always really proud to explain how we got Barry Bonds out. And somehow, I kept doing the same thing. Changeups, fastballs away. He'll fall off, and I had pretty good fastball. So for Barry, I wasn't a big name pitcher like Ken Hill, Jeff Fusaro, those guys that he had seen. So I was kind of flying under the radar, 97, 95, 97, good changeup. He'll fall off a couple. And then Barry was always unaware that I would just try to sneak those battles in.
Yep.
Boom. And he didn't expect a young player to challenge him that way. And I was doing that, but sneaky under the radar until he finally went to the video room and went, oh, I think this little shit is getting me on fastballs in. And if you watch, the other day I was watching and I saw the homer. That thing was like 97 in here, really close, and he just and hit the pole at the old stadium. And that was like a hurricane coming in from right field to left field. And he whacked that ball so hard that the ball hit the pole and came back. And when he was going by second base, he goes, I told you I was going to get you. I told you I was going to get you. And I got your brother, too. I was like, okay, you get mad at
bringing your brother into it.
No. It's like, I got you and I got your brother. And I was like, yeah, you did. And there's nothing I can do about it because I made a good pitch. But Barry Bonds was that unique guy that you just have to respect in all aspects of the game. Barry Bonds was the most complete player I ever faced I'm not disrespecting everybody else, and I never faced Henry Aaron or Willie Mays, but in my era, the player that I would say had everything that you wanted to see and more was Barry Bonds, because Barry Bonds could elevate the game to another level. On his own.
Yeah.
Could be taking the walks, could be running the bases, could be hitting homers, RBIs, scoring runs, aggressive, defense, everything you ask from a player, Barry Bonds had. And he had a pretty brilliant career. At that point, when you were just born, boy, just born.
I was going to say, that homer happens in 1995. He had a few more homers after that. So that was just, that was the middle, really, of the Bonds experience. Yeah. Pedro, our last topic for you before we let you go is probably not something that you talk about too much on when you're talking baseball on TBS, but it is something that we care deeply about and have become very invested in, and that is the Dominican Winter League. And your experience pitching for Licey early in your career, and I understand almost pitching for Licey at the end of your career, if I'm reading some of these reports correctly. Tell us what that experience did for you, what that league still means to you today, any strongest memories about pitching in your home country.
Well, it's probably the most important step for a young player developing. Why? Because it's short. You have to make it happen quick. You stop probably, that's when you really become a man. You stop being a teenager and you have to go into this environment for men. And the biggest and most important thing that happens to a player is that you will not get overwhelmed over failure or success, over loud environments, because the Winter League is like
the loudest.
Being a Fenway in the a loudest. World Series game
every day,
and in a 3-2 count with the bases loaded, it's just like that. The Winter League is short. The people are passionate. They're on you. You can feel the heat of the people. You have the dancers on top of the dugout. You have the music going, and you
a lot
have
of rum.
To still locate your pitch those 2 inches off.
Yeah,
those 2 inches up in the plate or down. Execute the breaking ball or flip that changeup in that environment, and they let you know. And you have the honks right on top of you as you're developing the pitch. Like, it's like a jungle, a fun jungle full of people dancing while you're doing your thing. It's like, I would say, a piano player and not being able to listen to the rhythm of the music, that's how you kind of play in the Winter League. And that's one big step for a young player developing.
Well, you look at Junior Caminero right now, playing for Tampa. This is nothing playing for the Rays compared to what he was doing last winter with the stakes and the fans and for Escogido, right? Like, once you can do it under that atmosphere and that environment, I mean, it must make the big leagues feel easier in a way.
Well, you just get so comfortable when you see the rules here, when you know you're protected, when you know you're not going to have anybody invading your space. But over there, right on top of the dugout, you're going to hear about every member of your family. You're going to hear about how you look. They're going to call you different things to try to distract you. It's like the most hostile but fun place to play
in
I would say, in Latin America. I know I'm not disrespecting Venezuela, Puerto Rico, Mexico, or anywhere, but you will never feel like you feel if you play in the Dominican, especially during the postseason. It's like people get into it, and it's broadcasters, it's the media members, it's the city, imagine when you have Licey and Escogido from the city, the middle of the city. You know what the bragging rights are? No people from the outside is coming in between us. Now it's bragging rights for the city. Who owns the city? And that's what makes it really interesting. And I was fortunate to play for Licey the entire time and be in the middle of the heat with the other teams. But my debut was in Santiago, Las Águilas.
Oh,
Las Águilas. It can be hostile. I remember the things that they called me when I was like starting to warm up, because my brother was like an Águilas killer, and I happened to come and do my debut in Santiago, and I'm facing Stanley Javier, I'm facing Moises Alou, Manny Ramirez, Polonia, and all those guys. And here is Ramon's little brother, smaller and skinnier than Ramon, trying to make my debut in Santiago. So imagine the things that they said to me.
Oh my
but
gosh.
I'm glad I got away with it. And
hey, it built you up. It built you up.
It,
you
can, it boosted
and,
me
and
up.
There you go.
If you can pitch in front of the Aguiluchos, you can pitch in front of anybody.
Oh my gosh. Oh my
but
gosh.
When you have Licey and Aguilas together too, that's becoming also just like Escogido and Licey.
Yeah, it is spicy. Well, that's why we care about it so much, and we are fortunate to be able to watch it now. It is a big part of our offseason experience. Pedro Martinez, thank you so much for the time. This was a real treat. You can watch Pedro on TBS, MLB on TBS, dispensing knowledge that only he can. We appreciate the time. This was a lot of fun, and we'll do it again sometime. Thank you so much, Pedro.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's always fun. See, I got excited. Oh, the Winter League over. The guy running for Cy Young. That's me. I love baseball. I'm a fan, too. I'm a big fan.
Pedro loves ball. Not a secret. Thank you, man.
Not a surprise.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. Thanks again to Pedro Martinez for coming on the podcast.
Good player.
That was cool. Good player, good pitcher. Pretty good dude. Gave us a lot of his time. We really appreciate it. All right. Speaking of great pitchers, boy, oh boy, maybe. Do we have a nuclear overreaction.
Sure, Pedro Martinez had a great career, but he's no Roky Sasaki. Roky Morning Leadoff himself has had quite a bizarre Roky season in the major leagues, coming over from Japan, struggling with the Dodgers. The fastball velocity was not the prince that was promised. Goes on the IL to rest, returns in the minor leagues in AAA, and is not throwing hard and is having a tough time. And with Roky Sasaki, whose fastball shape is suboptimal, he needs to be throwing cheddar cheese like he was over in Japan in order to let his elite splitter do its job. And last night, for the Oklahoma City Comets, no longer the Dodgers, Roky Sasaki was back with a capital B-A-C-K, my dear friends, maxing out at 100.6 miles an hour, averaging 98.5 on the heater, 6 pitches over 100, 16 whiffs and 35 swings, striking out 8 hitters. And I'm just ready to say we've crowned Paul Skenes the NL Cy Young, and I think that might be premature because Roky Sasaki, I mean, Jordan, 8 Ks in 4 2/3? Come on.
I mean, listen, by the Roky standards that he had set this year, that might as well be 80 Ks in 4 innings. Here's the deal. It's important to understand how we got here. Now, not even just like the full season, but even just the last few weeks, because you mentioned he goes on the IL with a shoulder injury. And listen, Roky's dealt with injuries recently. I mean, you can roll your eyes and be like, oh, he sucks. This is a phantom IL situation. I guess that's possible. But also, the dude's been hurt. He's dealt with stuff and the velo is down. So there was reason to be like, okay, yeah, he's probably hurt. Whether he was healthy or not, we know the stuff was not very good over his first handful of major league starts. And the stuff was also not good in his first 4 rehab starts, to the point where when Dave Roberts was asked about this, I was there in Pittsburgh and we're all like, hey, what's going on with Roky? He's still rehabbing. And Dave Roberts is like, yeah, like it hasn't been good enough. Like we need this stuff to take up. Like if he's going to pitch on this major league team that now has most of these guys healthy, you have to be way better than this. Like, you would really have to be pitching well to warrant consideration at this point in the season. They were not just going to force him into this pitching staff in his current form. But that was that current form. This current form, which is the version that we basically didn't see at any point before. I mean, the velo was up to 100 very occasionally, like I think in spring and over his first few starts, but not really. I mean, it was not holding deep into outings like this. And as you mentioned, the fastball shape, it was basically performing like the worst fastball in the league. Now, that was not just the fact that it wasn't hard enough and the movement was bad. His command was horrible. And so before this injury, before this, even though he has this special splitter, everything else was so bad that he was a very bad major league pitcher. But if the velo is back, if he's now throwing what appears to be a new pitch, because before the injury, he was throwing a slider in the mid-80s that was okay, that was trying to give him a third pitch. Now he's throwing something closer to a cutter that's, you know, in the low 90s. Now we're talking here. The splitter velo is also up, and you're sitting with the fastball velo at 98. Now, if you can get two other, secondary pitches, and off-speed and a breaking ball that are effective and your command is even average, now your fastball shape doesn't really matter if it's 90, because it's 98, 99. And in short stints, I think you can get hitters out. And you kind of saw it in this outing. Once it got to the fifth inning, he really started to crumble. Both the velo went down, the command totally abandoned him. But even for three innings, it is not hard to see that version to be like, there is a version of this pitcher that can be useful. Now, his ultimate ceiling, his ultimate potential, there are still so many questions about that. But if we're talking about, can this guy help the Dodgers win the World Series this year? That version can. Where that version has been, why he suddenly is throwing this much harder, I have no idea. That this is very, very strange, but it is certainly an encouraging and intriguing development.
How many postseason innings does he throw? Let's do innings, which is kind of the same thing.
So here's the thing. I actually think, again, the Dodgers have some work to do if they're going to avoid the wild card, right?
Mm-hmm.
And if they don't, like, I could totally see a situation where they're in the wild card series. Maybe that goes three games. And those first couple games of the DS, like, they need some arms. They need some arms. They are going to have to get creative over those first couple games. And I could see Roky factoring into that. So, again, I still don't really trust the durability, let alone the command.
Like, he
still
has
so much more to prove. But
give me a number.
I think he's going to pitch. I think he's going to pitch in the postseason now. I really do. And I think you don't.
I don't.
So I don't think I have to give a number. Like, yeah, I'm going all the way away. But it feels ridiculous. Like, this is a nuclear overreaction. But, like, that version is so much better than what it was. Like, the version before was irrelevant. I was writing him off. I was ready. I said this in our meeting last week. We do not have to talk about this guy anymore. We got to talk about that. That is a version that can get outs. And this bullpen is not good. Jake, this bullpen's not good. Okay? So if they think that he can get a few outs here and there in relief, I think they're going to do it. So I think, yes, I think Roky pitches in the postseason. I think the Dodgers survive long enough for him to pitch in the postseason. It will not be in a starting role. That is my prediction.
I think there is too much volatility here, and that's why I will say zero innings. If he comes out and throws 100 in his next start, I will reserve the right to change that prediction. I think he won't show up in his next start throwing this hard. We have more evidence that he's not going to throw 100 than he is going to throw 100 stateside, right?
Yep.
Like, if he showed up throwing 96 in his next minor league start, if he does that, he's not making the playoff roster. You know, like, I just don't think that's happening.
Who's to know what happens after that? I mean, this is the thing. This is why this is such a preposterous situation.
Okay.
Why would we? This is why I completely wrote him off last week.
Great. For me, the velo is great. The lack of command is the bigger deal here. Where when he was pitching at the beginning of the season in the big leagues, it was broadside of a barn, like, need a GPS, no tracking system, hope the strike zone is somewhere where the ball ends up, right? That's not the type of dude who can throw in October. Like, do you think, I worry about, hey, game three of the NLDS in San Diego, we're going to send Roki Sasaki out there to pee his pants? Like,
hey,
I don't know if the Dodgers will do that.
How high the leverage is, I'm not saying it's, I just think that if he can stay healthy, honestly, the best thing he could do right now is to stop pitching. And whatever you just did, just hold that and work and just keep it in waiting. And then let's just ease it in and have him ready in some sort of bullpen role. Because whatever, yep. Like I said, is he going to be a starter long term? Who cares? That doesn't matter right now. He's obviously not cracking this rotation in any form. But I am. So it's fine. This is a very appropriate for a nuclear. I just think that it's not. I agree with the command, but all of it. The fact that there's a new pitch. The fact that the splitter was still getting whiffs, and he was a terrible pitcher for 8 months, sir, for eight starts. So I think that the state of the Dodgers bullpen is also very relevant to this conversation, where they're going to be like, you know what, this dude's still better than whatever we're rolling out there right now. So that sure. is also maybe not a good thing. But I'll do it. I'll say Roki at least one postseason appearance. We'll see how that goes. So
great.
But I was down on this guy as much as anybody. I'm just telling you that version is something that this team I think could use in some form. We will see if that ends up actually happening. All right, a few more topics before we say goodbye. Let's go around the league. Let's begin in Yolo County, where Connelly Early, rookie left-hander. Yes, the Red Sox have another one. Peyton Tolley is not alone. Here comes Connelly Early with 11 strikeouts over five scoreless innings in his MLB debut. And this is another one like Peyton Tolley where it's like, whoa, where did this guy come from? How did we get this guy to the big league so quickly? Very interesting path. Started his college career at Army, transferred to UVA. To kind of have his stuff tick up a little bit more, facing better competition than what the Patriot League had to offer. Red Sox draft him. Stuff ticks up even further in pro ball, just as it has for a lot of Red Sox pitching prospects recently. They're doing something right. And now here he comes. Dustin May goes on the IL. Walker Buehler's gone, as they're doing in Queens. Let the kids pitch. And I don't know if Connelly Early is going to start a playoff game, but right now the Red Sox are trying to get all the wins they can get. And it was a really, really impressive performance. A great tweet from broadcaster in front of the show, Mike Monaco, that Connelly Early had never had 11 strikeouts in a game, really at any level. Most strikeouts in the minors was 10. Most strikeouts in college was 10. 11 strikeouts in his MLB debut, matching a Red Sox record. So, like I said, I don't know how much we're going to see Connelly Early down the stretch, but even one start like this is incredibly encouraging. Also interesting that like we got Connelly Early and Peyton Tolley before Kyle Harrison, who's a name that's completely been lost. I think he's actually coming up to pitch finally this week, it sounds like. But he was seemingly the prize in the Devers trade. And because God knows Jordan Hicks isn't. I mean, he's been actively losing games for Boston. So, you know, and they already traded
Kyle Harrison.
James Tibbs. They already traded James Tibbs for Dustin May. Oh, okay. That doesn't feel as good. But anyway, Kyle Harrison could be something for them. Yes, this is for Kyle Harrison could be something. But either way, that's another young lefty we can look forward to pitching in this rotation as they all try and be like Garrett Crochet, I guess.
Kyle Harrison feels like Vaughn Grissom pitcher version.
I hope not. I am way more optimistic about Kyle Harrison, but we will see. Anyway, the Red Sox.
Also, Connelly Early. Connelly, first name in the big leagues ever. And the first Early since Early Win.
Oh, of first or last. How about that?
First or last Connelly. Early since Early Win. Been a minute.
Okay. Wow. More like Connelly late. What's taking so long? Anyway, the Red Sox, who are playing better.
No.
Kicking the crap out of the Yolo A's. They are now tied with the New York Yankees, who lost in, I say embarrassing fashion. I mean, they're due for one of these every 2 weeks at this point. I know they've been playing better, but boy, when the Yankees lose, they really lose. I mean, they are really losing. They are losing hard. I know it just counts as one loss in the standings, but this eternal seventh inning where multiple pitchers recorded zero outs against the Tigers, right after we talked about, hey, Yankees playing better against good teams. See if they can keep it going against Detroit. Will Warren has a good start. And then Fernando Cruz and Mark Leiter Jr. combined to record zero outs and allow, I think, 8 runs or something in a total meltdown of epic proportions, overshadowing Aaron Judge's historic home run, passing Yogi Berra on the all-time Yankees home run list. But which is, by the way, amazing. Like, holy crap, Aaron Judge. And he's going to probably pass Joe DiMaggio before the end of the season. And he will keep hitting home runs. We will see how high he can climb on that list. But yeah, that doesn't totally distract from what was an absolutely embarrassing loss that drops them back in a tie with the Red Sox.
Only one error, though. Only one error. If I told you that the Yankees had allowed 12 runs, you'd be like, dude, Volpe throw a ball to Queens or something. No, just one error. And it was after all the bad stuff really happened. So silver linings for the Yankees defense.
That said, they, because of that loss and because the Blue Jays, what a win. Oh my goodness, this was a fun game to watch. Big comeback against the Astros. Yeah.
May I defend Craig Kimbrel for a moment? So Craig Kimbrel gets the loss in this game, all right? And if you see the box, you're like, I cannot believe the Astros are running Craig Kimbrel out there. Oh my God. Go watch the ball game, okay? Craig Kimbrel, you know, in extra innings, man for man on second, Vlad Guerrero infield single that, you know, geriatric Jose Altuve can't make a play on, strikes out a guy first and third with one, grounder to first, infield zin, Christian Walker diving stop, can't get the out at home. Craig Kimbrel is out there doing his best. And as someone who just turned 30 and feels old, I feel a need to defend Craig Kimbrel. And I'm doing that right now. Thank you for listening. But you're right. The Blue Jays win that game. They push the lead back out to 3 games in the AL East to remain in the driver's seat. The one last thing to bring up before we get on out of here, the Guardians are alive with the Sound of Music. They have won 5 consecutive baseball games, beating Kansas City twice, the first 2 games in a 4-game set. They have a near no-no on Monday with Slade Ciccone, the first C.
Nailed it. Nailed it.
Is that right?
Good job. Yep, you got it.
It's tough because you want it to be, it could be so many different things. It could be Ciccone, 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 or any combo of, like, C is a very versatile letter. Anyway, he, no-no on Monday, and then Joey Chantillo, right, follows with 8 scoreless innings on Tuesday. I think it was like the first time in 29 years or 8,000 millennia that the Guardians had like back-to-back scoreless starts or something over a certain amount of innings. Saw some stat about that on the internet machine.
I should know that. I didn't even see that, but I believe it.
Get your numbers up, Jordan. Anyway, that's the deal with the Guardians. They're back in the mix. I believe they're 2 games back in the AL wild card. Anything else before we get on out of here?
Well, yeah, I mean, just, again, standings-wise, it's like, oh, man, Rangers keep winning, Guardians keep winning, Mariners are sweating. Mariners keep winning, and the Astros' loss means the Mariners are only 1 game back. So the real chaotic scenario that is in play here is if Seattle passes Houston and suddenly Houston's worried about making the postseason, the fact that the Rangers and Mariners are just 2.5 back of Houston, hey, maybe we do have some playoff races here down the stretch. And the Giants are only 2 back of the Mets. How about that? So we will see what else these next few games give us, but we'll be back on Friday. Thank you to Pedro Martinez for joining us. We appreciate you, Pedro Martinez. That was really cool. You can email us at baseballbarbacast@gmail.com. Thank you to TJ Brassel and Andrew Hartz for producing. As always, we'll talk to you all later this week.